not directly, anyway. But I believe that I can actually, I'm actually really quite excited to be here because I think I'm being able to take what a field that's developing actively in pedology and beginning to apply it to ecology and possibly even biogeochemistry and kind of give you an idea of what's kind of up and coming. And so I'm looking at digital soil mapping. Let me explain quickly what digital soil mapping is. Basically, it's very similar to species distribution modeling. We have a soil property or soil class, and we try to quantitatively predict it across the landscape, and resulting in an image or a raster product of soil properties across the landscape. My name is Colby Brungard. I'm a researcher at Utah State University in Logan, Utah, and I'm working on with some collaborators from the USGS Nature Conservancy and the NRCS to develop ecological sites, and I'll tell you what ecological sites are in a second, but this presentation makes a lot more sense. Let's see here. If we talk about the area of study first. So here's a map of Utah, where you can see it. Salt Lake City is right here, the Great Salt Lake, and the area that I'll be talking about today is down here highlighted in the red. It's an area called Beef Basin. It's about 52,000 acres, and it's just south of Canyonlands National Park. So this is the classic, beautiful, red rock, kind of southeastern Utah, all the area where people go to see all of the national parks. And this area happens to be a particularly important wildlife habitat. The area inside the polygon, the red polygon, is our study area, and it's this sort of relatively open, flat parkland in the middle of all of these cliffs and canyons. And this area had historically had very high sagebrush cover, which sagebrush is good winter range for deer. And historically, in the 1980s, there's reports of there being a herd of 10,000 deer in this area. And as of last year, I think there was a herd of about 100. And so this is some sort of combination of land use and climate has significantly decreased the sagebrush. There's historical aerial photos that say that you can go out and look at the photo, you know where it was taken, you say, there was a lot of sagebrush and there's none there now. This picture here, all of these, let's see if I can get this cursor to come up here, there we go. All of these are basically dead sagebrush carcasses. And death of sagebrush has led to a decrease in deer. So in this particular area, land managers, and particularly the BLM, has really, the Bureau of Land Management, really pressured by a number of outside groups to restore sagebrush in an effort to try and increase deer numbers so that the hunting will be better, essentially. And to do this, they're proposing to use rangeland drills, burning, chaining, some fairly drastic vegetation restoration measures. And in this particular area, there's not only there's cattle grazing, a number of other people, some other stakeholders are really interested in this particular area, and they're kind of concerned that these treatments won't be effective. In fact, you might treat it and wind up in a completely desired different ecosystem than what you want. You chain it, it'll blow away, and the sagebrush won't ever be able to come back. So this seems like a ready-made state for an ecological site and a state in transition model. So really briefly, an ecological site is a way, it's a land classification. It's a way to identify an area for a land manager that says, if I apply a treatment to this particular area, it should all respond the same. If I chain it, it's all going to come back in sagebrush. Or if I do something else, it'll all turn to grass. And a state and transition model is essentially when you're inside an ecological site, you have you're in some box here. You say this is a sagebrush site, and we grazed it, and now it's a grass. Dominantly has grass, and maybe there's some sort of vegetation manipulation or treatment that we could implement that would bring it back to whatever desired condition you want. So they're very powerful for land management. I think I pushed the wrong button. And in Beef Basin, there's two dominant ecological sites. They're both sandy, for those of you familiar with ecological sites, they're both a semi-desert sandy loam. But one's a four-wing big sagebrush. It supports dominantly Wyoming big sagebrush, and the other one is a four-wing saltbrush site. So I'll show you pictures of those in just a moment. But the problem is that these ecological sites, while they would be great to use for management, they're not distinguishable in this area. We can't tell where they are in the landscape. They're complicated, they're intermingled, there's been a lot of change, and in the ecological site description, which is the document that tells you why they should be different, there's no consistent no consistent pattern as to why they are different in this landscape. So here's an example of these two. So in the what's the difference between these two ecological sites? Here's one, this four-winged saltbrush. You can see it has a lot of grasses. It supports four-winged saltbrush, which is a shrub, but it's not anywhere anything like the semi-desert sandy loam Wyoming big sagebrush, which supports very healthy stands of Wyoming big sagebrush. And this is kind of the desired condition that we would like to have out there, or that the land managers would like to have out there. This area, the four-winged saltbrush typically tends to grow in really dry areas, and the Wyoming big sagebrush tends to require more moisture. So we believe that there's some sort of subsurface moisture holding capacity that's driving differences out here. But up till now, we haven't been able to consistently identify the reason that these are differences. So we looked at a number of properties, and I'm just going to show you here three. But we had 97 soil profile observations from Dean Shoup and April Darger's lab. It was part of April's master's research. And what I want to just highlight right here is that in the sagebrush site, which you can see on the, the right-hand side in the big oval, we looking at soil depth, excavated to the median is about 100 centimeters. So what this is saying is that there's a bedrock contact. You go down about a meter, and there's a bedrock contact. Whereas on the four-winged saltbrush site, we see that the median is greater than about 160 centimeters. And actually what this means is that we just couldn't dig any deeper. The auger stuff, we couldn't go any deeper. And so actually these are probably much deeper soils. And so in this area, these are all of these soils are derived from sandstone. And so basically the four-winged site, four-winged saltbrush is a really deep pile of sand, and the sagebrushes are a much shallower pile of sand. And so I use digital soil mapping to predict soil depth. For those who are not familiar with digital soil mapping, this will make sense when I show you an image. But we use random forests and several topographic and spectral covariates. And what we did is we came up with this, we predicted this map. And so this is the let me get my mouse here. Oh, there it is. So this is the Beef Basin area. These are the soil map unit polygons, these dark lines overlaying everything. And the brown color are very deep soils, typically a soil with, you would think that's something without a bedrock. This is actually a continuous soil property now. So for each pixel in this, and it's a 10-meter pixel, each pixel has a predicted soil depth. And so brown soils are brown areas are very deep soils. The yellow areas are sort of somewhere in between, and then the green areas are very shallow areas. And so what does this mean for land managers? How could we use this? And eventually I'll get to why should biogeochemists and ecologists care about this. Well, for a land manager, we can generate detailed ecological site maps, which would actually guide management application in the field. If you're going to take a tractor out there, or a bulldozer, or start a fire, you actually need to identify a place on the landscape where we can implement these management goals. And so I'm still working on how to do this. Unfortunately, I'm a few months behind. We ran into some archaeological clearance issues that wouldn't let us dig there. So I'm like 12 months behind, actually. But so we're still working on actually how do you do this? How do you generate an ecological site map from these continuous soil predictions? But what I think is also really interesting is that we can assess risk or cost benefit. We can actually begin to put dollars with this. If we're going to say, we're going to go out and we're going to implement chaining, or we're going to burn an area, I know how much that costs per acre. And so I can say, well, you have a high success rate on let's say you've got a high success rate on 1,000 acres, a moderate success rate on maybe 2,000 acres, and past that, you probably won't get your desired and so your result. And so you begin to assess this cost benefit. How much am I willing to spend? How much money am I actually going to invest in this particular land management goal versus my potential reward? Okay, so beyond ecological sites, how is digital soil mapping possibly useful for studying earthworms or for looking at soil carbon? Right, if you're going to stratify a land, soil maps typically give it a soil taxonomy name, like spodosols or inceptosols, but there's a great deal of variability. So this begins to allow us to express, I'm going to go back up one slide, the actual variability of soils across the landscape. So let's say that for a particular reason you are really interested in measuring soil carbon, you now know within this landscape in a very detailed places where you might have deep soils. And for some reason, perhaps soil carbon or earthworms only occur on deep soils. You could actually go to these places and say, within some confidence interval, I'm pretty sure that this is a soil that's 100 centimeters deep. But so that's one particular use. But also, the collaborators that I'm working with are all ecologists, and they're really beginning to be very excited because when we couple digital soil maps with historical vegetation information, historical climate, and also land use data sets, then we can really begin to tease apart what are the temporal vegetation dynamics. If I have a photo that shows that it switched from sagebrush to grass, and I also have some information about the climate and the soils and also the land use, I can begin to understand what is driving this landscape. What's really happening? Is it a droughty soil? There just happened to be a really bad drought and we combined it with overgrazing and you lost all your sagebrush. You can begin to understand some of these really interesting temporal dynamics and also sort of the interplay between climate and land management decisions. And so with that, I leave you with a pretty picture of the area and ask for any questions. Thank you.
I might have missed it, but could you clarify what went into the predicted soil depth?
You bet. I did gloss over that intentionally. So I used surface reflectance from a Landsat 5 image, and then I also used several terrain derivatives, so slope curvature, profile curvature, elevation, slope, to try and predict soil depth. Yeah, so that is a strength of being able to use of imagery in sort of dry land soils, is that you can actually look at the soil surface.
What else? I have a question.
Yes.
So the ramification of this is that it's one soil, and you're separating it into two separate ecological sites that are going to be very difficult to discern on the landscape.
Right.
So will those be able, should those be two separate soils?
So could you actually distinguish these on the landscape?
Yeah.
That is kind of a big question that I have right now.
Yeah.
So if one of the things that I didn't show with these is that you actually, we're looking at just the mean response, but I also have a confidence interval. It's, 25 to 75 centimeters. What's my prediction? How accurate is that, my actual prediction? So that's the question, is how do we integrate this error into separating it into some, and so inherently it's a management, and we're just classifying it this way because it's useful for management. So
you
could group it some other way if you wanted.
Well, thank you, Colby.